The following podcast contains advertising. To access an ad-free version of the Lawfare podcast, become a material supporter of Lawfare at patreon.com/lawfare. That's patreon.com/lawfare. Also, check out Lawfare's other podcast offerings, Rational Security, Chatter, Lawfare No Bull, and The Aftermath.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
I would expect, Rand Paul and Bernie Sanders notwithstanding, that most of the political energy in the next year and a quarter in the presidential election is going to be to push to the right in defense terms, and that we will see major candidates of both parties advocating at least modest increases in defense spending, recognizing that threats have gone up a bit, and we haven't even talked about Russia and Ukraine. And that, as Chairman Bernanke just said, we don't have to be so rushed in our concern about bringing down the deficit as to ignore what might be needed for broader national security purposes. Now, I'm not suggesting we're going to have a 2015 or 2017 equivalent of the Reagan buildup, but I think we will see modest real growth proposed by either party's presidential candidate once we get through it. The next 6 weeks are interesting in Washington because of the looming sequester, and frankly, I'm a little surprised that that there hasn't been a better effort by the two branches of government responsible for this to make sure we don't sequester defense at this juncture. I think it would be a big, big mistake.
I'm Cody Poplin, and this is the Lawfare Podcast, August 22nd, 2015. That was Mike O'Hanlon you just heard, co-director of the Center for 21st Century Security and Intelligence and director of research and foreign policy at Brookings. With Congress away, the Economist will play. And last week, Brookings hosted a discussion on the health of the U.S. national security industrial base. The panel, which also featured Brookings scholars Ben Bernanke and Mark Miro, looks across the spectrum at both the security and economic sides of the defense economy, evaluating the effects of sequestration, how America's needs are informed by the threats it faces, and exactly what impact does defense spending have on regional and national job creation and technological innovation. It's the Lawfare Podcast, episode number 137, The American Defense Economy and the Future of American Prosperity.
Good morning. I'm Mike O'Hanlon from the Foreign Policy Program at Brookings. I'm joined by my colleagues Ben Bernanke and Mark Muro. Ben is with the Economic Studies Program and the Hutchins Center. Mark is with our Metropolitan Studies Program. And we're here to talk today about defense and the defense sector more generally and its effects on the U.S. economy and vice versa. So there's a lot on the table. And we're going to talk about everything from defense's role in short-term economic policy or effects on short-term growth to longer-term issues about defense's role in potentially aiding the development of research and development technologies, the ways in which defense can help the economy and vice versa, but of course also the way in which defense spending is a significant part of our budget and our budget deficit. So it runs both ways, and we're trying to discuss all these different implications. My job this morning as moderator is first to frame a couple of the broad considerations here before introducing Ben and Mark and then asking each of them a few questions. We'll spend about half the time doing that and then go to you for your questions. I think you all know, beyond the broad interest in this question, the importance of the subject right now. Congress is soon to return home to Washington and to face the question of how to avert a potential sequester or even a shutdown. And defense and debates over defense spending are a part of that conversation, to be sure. We're all watching presidential candidates, and for those of you who are watching a lot of C-SPAN these days, this is not the Iowa State Fair. None of us at present are running for president, although perhaps one of us should be. But we are going to still talk about defense's role in broader economic strategy and broader national competitiveness in an era when we all know these issues have been first and front and foremost in voters' minds, as they should be. Let me, before I introduce Ben and Mark, and then go to some questions for each of them, let me just say a couple more words to put defense spending in perspective. And I'm going to try not to overdo the statistics, speaking here out loud without a lot of visual props and therefore not wanting to drown you in numbers. But I think a couple of them would be useful. And as you probably know, some of you, defense is now representing, the defense sector is representing a little less than 3.5% of our gross domestic product. So just under 3.5%. That's a downward slope from about 4.5% at the very end of the Bush years, early Obama years, when the wars were at their peak. And we're headed downward now towards perhaps 3% of gross domestic product at the very end of the Obama presidency. And projections would have it decline further thereafter, although who knows what the world will bring, what the next president and Congress will bring. By historical standards, this is a modest burden on the U.S. economy, certainly compared to anything in the World War II or post-World War II era. In the Clinton years, we were also around 3%, but in the Reagan years, we had been up closer to 6% of GDP, defense as a fraction of overall national economic activity. And in much of the 1950s and 60s, the figure was often 8% to 10%. So that's just one way to put it in perspective. But also, of course, defense spending is still very big. It's still almost $600 billion a year. Still about 15% of the federal budget. That's much reduced from earlier periods, but it's still a large fraction of the overall budget, to be clear and to be sure. And therefore, this is certainly one of the main ways in which the federal government interacts with the broader economy. So if we just frame things in those terms, I think you begin to get a sense of the importance of the sector. A few more statistics, and then for the real show here. Even though defense is only a little more than 3% of national GDP, it can be a lot more in certain parts of the country. And that's certainly one of the things that I know Mark is going to talk about, and I'll say why his interests have taken him in those directions in just a moment. But we're just across the river from Virginia. Virginia has the highest defense concentration or dependency of any state. 13% of Virginia's gross state output is defense spending of one sort or another. By the way, when I say defense in this context, I'm including the intelligence community, and I'm including also the nuclear weapons activities of the Department of Energy. I'm not including Veterans Affairs, not including Homeland Security, just to be very clear on definitions, although you can certainly bring those subjects into discussion if you wish a little bit later on. Here in D.C. and in Maryland, defense is more like 6% of state or local economic output. So it's substantial. Another way to look at it is in terms of defense's role in high technology, in promoting manufacturing, research, and development. And again, here the defense sector is a bigger share of the national economy than that 3% of GDP number would imply. So for example, in national manufacturing, military procurement's about $100 billion a year, national manufacturing output's around $2 trillion, so it's 5%. Of national manufacturing output, and a lot more in certain sectors like aerospace, space launch, some others that we'll talk about today. One last way of looking at it, research and development. Research and development spending, by some metrics, defense and related activities are 20% of all national research and development. Now that probably overstates things, and I'm not going to bore you with all the details right now, but it's probably fair to say that as a fraction of overall national research and development, the defense sector can be attributed to maybe 10% of total activity in this domain. And that's largely government money. It's also to some extent the money of defense contractors as they're looking to promote new ideas for the future. So as you can see, there's a lot going on. The technologies that are at issue include not only aerospace, as I mentioned earlier, cyber, propulsion, advanced materials, nanotechnology, a number of other things that are going to be central in our future national competitiveness more broadly defined. So that's why today's subjects are important. And again, we're very grateful that you would come out on a hot August morning to join us here. Mark Murrow has been at Brookings now for about 8 years. Like Ben, he's a Harvard grad. He then went to Berkeley for his graduate work and then spent a lot of time in Arizona, certainly one of the up-and-coming states by many measures of advanced industry, and that's going to be one of the things we talk about today. He worked as a journalist and also as a scholar in Arizona before joining the Metropolitan Studies Program. One of my favorite studies that he's worked on at Brookings is called Launch! Exclamation mark, and it's about Colorado and its role in the space launch industry and ways in which national government, local government, public sector, private sector, universities can work together to further the competitive advantage that Colorado already had. And that's just a case study of the broader dynamics that we'll be talking about today. He's also done a good deal of writing on advanced industries more generally in the United States and on green technology and a few other things. Ben Bernanke needs no introduction. We're very, very grateful to have him at Brookings, where he is, as I say, a scholar in economic studies and at the Hutchins Center. As you know, he was chairman of the Federal Reserve from 2006 through 2014. He and I were both born in Augusta, Georgia. I won't claim that I knew him then, but I have known him since the 1980s when he was a professor at Princeton when I was a graduate student. Let me just say he was one of the most supportive, collegial, and encouraging professors back then, and his personality has not changed in the slightest, despite the fame that he's accumulated since that time. He was on the Council of Economic Advisors prior to being chairman of the Fed and had had other roles in the Fed as well. He was at Princeton through the 1990s, essentially, as chairman of the Economic Studies or Economic Department, and also with the Woodrow Wilson School. So he was at Princeton from the mid-80s through the early 2000s. His PhD was at MIT. And for those of you who also haven't yet discovered it, you should definitely check out Ben Bernanke's blog. It is one of the most entertaining and sometimes even tricks you into learning some macroeconomics along the way. So I was reading the other day his views on whether Alexander Hamilton should be taken off the $10 bill, and I learned a lot of fiscal policy and monetary policy in the process. By the way, the answer is no, but I'm sure you can say more later on if you wish. But he also blogged about the Washington Nationals back in July, and maybe he'll have more to say on that subject as well. but maybe not. Before we launch into questions, let me, since we have the opportunity here to thank Ben for his service to the country, let me please ask you to join me in doing that right now. And I'm going to begin with him. Let me say, this is not a sneak preview of his book, The Courage to Act, which will be, I think, his fourth or fifth book. He wrote economics textbooks at Princeton. He also wrote essays on the Great Depression when he was a professor in an earlier period and working with the Fed. And so this book will come out on October 4th, and it will be, I'm sure, much acclaimed and much watched, but there will be different events about that. But today is not one of them. Ben, I'd like to begin by, first of all, thanking you again for joining us with this discussion and asking you initially just how do you think about the size of the defense budget and the appropriateness from an economics perspective?
Well, thanks, Mike, and thanks for inviting me to speak on this top important topic today. We haven't known each other for a long time, not in Augusta. I was a lot older than you, but at Princeton, and I've followed Mike's work ever since then. I always found him to be one of the most thoughtful and balanced writers about national defense. Also, full disclosure, obviously, I'm not a defense expert. I am an economist, though, and I hope to be able to bring that perspective to help us understand the role of the military and defense in the U.S. economy. You ask about the size of the military, and you cited before a whole bunch of numbers, the total spending. Obviously, those numbers are important for thinking about the amount of resources that are being used in the national defense. But I guess I want to start by being anti-economic and saying that those dollar figures are not necessarily a very good measure of capabilities and potentialities. One number, just to take the opportunity, one number that bothers me a lot is the journalistic tendency to say, well, the United States spends more than the rest of our, you know, potential competitors combined, therefore we are militarily secure. And I think that's obviously a mistake from a lot of ways. We have different goals, different needs. But in particular, there's the problem of making comparisons across countries using exchange rates to try to evaluate qualitative differences. So if I'm comparing the living standards of the United States and China, I don't want to look simply at exchange rate adjusted GDP per person. Instead, I want to do what economists call a purchasing power parity comparison, which means that I want to take into account that labor is much cheaper in China, therefore haircuts, for example, which may be, who knows, of equal quality to those you get in Washington, in China are much cheaper and contribute much less to the GDP, but nevertheless, any attempt to compare the standard of living of the United States and China needs to take into account those differences in costs. And the same thing applies to the military. And the comparison of labor costs between U.S. and China is a good case in point. Did a little bit of work before the session to try to figure out the relevant numbers, and what best we could find, Peter Olson, my research assistant, and I worked on this a little bit, best we could find is that the U.S. military calculates that we spend about $110,000 for each active military member. We're talking now about pay and benefits. We're not talking about training. We're not talking about equipment. We're just talking about sort of the personnel costs. We spend about $90,000 per person for each civilian member of the defense effort. In comparison, the per worker, an urban worker in China earns about $9,000 a year. And so I don't know exactly what the Chinese personnel costs are, but they're obviously a lot less than $110,000. So this is an example of how just looking at, you know, dollar figures or renminbi figures can be deceptive. This is something, by the way, this is something that the defense industry, that defense specialists, I think, understand. The Pentagon and the State Department do calculate PPP comparisons, and you find in that case, for example, that under PPP comparisons, instead of being 45% of world military spending, U.S. military spending is more like a third of global spending. So these comparisons are important. Ultimately, I think we should understand, and I'm the right person to say this, that economics can only take us so far. In the end, in thinking about the size of the military and our resource expenditures, we need to think about our foreign policy goals, the threats we might face, the capacities we need to develop, and ultimately, of course, the long-run budget constraints that we ultimately do face. But this is just a small pitch for thinking about things in purchasing power parity terms and in more utilitarian terms rather than simply in dollar functions. So that's, I think, an important initial point to make.
Thank you. And we'll come back to the defense budget relative to the broader government budget and its fiscal drain a little bit later. But let me ask you first about something that you had to deal with in the last 5-6 years, which is defense spending coming down at a time when you were trying to, along with other policymakers, figure out a way to get the United States out of recession. How are those two dynamics linked? Did defense cuts complicate your task? How much did they affect the way you looked at the problem?
Well, so defense spending, military spending, is connected to growth through a number of different mechanisms. And you're thinking specifically of what you would call the Keynesian demand side mechanism. How much does spending on military functions, how much does it affect the total demand in the economy? And in particularly a situation where you have unemployment, high unemployment or recession, standard textbook macroeconomics says that increased spending will increase activity by adding to the demand for goods and services. Generally speaking, I think it's best to keep the military preparedness goals separate from these short-run cyclical considerations. Not to say they're not sometimes important. The most obvious example was, of course, World War II, where this enormous national effort in World War II brought the U.S. economy out of the Great Depression and had an enormous impact on total output, and it lasted even beyond the war. A more negative example would be the 1960s, when the Vietnam effort contributed to the overheating of the U.S. economy and led to the inflation, in part, that we saw in the 1970s. So it can be important, but there's no sense necessarily in which that the changes in defense spending will be, the move in the direction that you would want from a purely cyclical point of view. Recently, military spending is now a much smaller share of GDP than it was, obviously, in the 40s or certainly in the 60s. And so the effects are much smaller, but they were mildly negative, I think, in the last few years. Starting around 2010, the drawdowns in military spending were a negative in U.S. GDP growth, up to a point of 3 or 4 tenths on growth in GDP. Not enormous, but noticeable. And that was in turn partly due to the drawdown of the wars in Afghanistan and Iraq, but also in part due to the deliberate budget cutting that took place in 2010. And in fact, the worst year in terms of adverse effects was 2013, which was a very negative year in terms of fiscal contraction and the effects on our economy. So I guess I would summarize by saying that, first, that the effects on demand side growth last few years have been mildly negative. Part of it was completely understandable. Certainly, you wouldn't want to determine the resources devoted to the Iraq and Afghanistan in any way by U.S. Cyclical conditions. But the other part, I think, was to some extent a self-inflicted wound, since all these cuts were made for presumably economic reasons, but in fact they went mostly in the wrong direction in the sense that they were a mild negative in an economy that was trying to recover. We'll come back to it, I'm sure, but you know, there are many other connections between military spending and the defense establishment and economic growth, but in the particular this particularly narrow case of the effects on total demand, it's less of a deal than it used to be because defense spending is a smaller part of the economy. But I think unwisely that the cuts in military spending, which were not motivated by defense needs last few years, were actually a negative in terms of our economic recovery.
So as you mentioned about specific sectors and getting into that in a little bit more detail and looking at national research and development, I wondered if you had specific thoughts on which technology sectors were most important where defense does contribute, or just generally how to think about this problem. We were talking earlier, and many people here remember, of course, that in previous eras, defense had a huge role in creating advanced technologies or promoting them. Everything from nuclear technology in the 1940s, helicopters, advanced jet engines, a number of other technologies, the invention of the internet, many other things. Defense was crucial, and then, of course, NASA contributed as well, if we think more generally about the federal role. Today, it's a much smaller fraction of overall research and development spending, just as defense is a smaller fraction of GDP. Do you still think there are areas where it's particularly important?
So broadly, we were talking about the growth connection through demand. I think the most important in medium and long term, by far the most important effects of military spending are on the supply side of the economy. And that works through a number of different mechanisms, including training and other things. But by far the most important, certainly in the United States, has been the linkages between defense, military appropriations, and broader technological trends. That's where it's one of the major sources of U.S. growth over time. We remain technological leader. It's one of our national strengths. And so it's very first order importance to try to understand the relationship between what the military is doing and what's happening in terms of productivity and technology. So let's just specify that that is a critical issue, and we need to understand that. Now, from an economist's point of view, there's actually a sort of a standard argument which says that the government ought to be conducting basic research. And that goes back to Ken Arrow, Nobel Prize winner, Larry Summers' uncle, so that's another qualification he has. The argument basically is that most basic research, scientific research, it may have tremendous economic returns, but they're very hard for the scientist or the engineer to capture because this is just basic, broad-based research. And so there's a case for the government to subsidize that kind of basic research through grants or through direct activities and so on. So that's kind of the intellectual case for government research. The fact is, though, if you look at the composition of federally sponsored research, most of it is not basic, you know, fundamental science. Most of it is what you might call mission-related research. That is, rather than studying the basic properties of atoms, you know, most of the federally funded research would be about how to, you know, incorporate our understanding of, you know, nuclear forces into a missile system or whatever it might be. So that's a more subtle question. So given that we have much more focus on mission-related research as opposed to basic research, you know, what's the connection between what the government does and what the private sector does? As you pointed out, the federal R&D is big. It's about 40% of total U.S. R&D, about half of that being military. It's been coming down over time, but it's still a very big component. Now, as you look at this area, a lot of what you get is the anecdotes, and there are a lot of great stories going back to the Manhattan Project and so on, and there are many examples of military R&D or defense-related R&D, which has been very productive on the private sector side. An example that I like is laser technology, which was begun as a military application, but there have since been something like 55,000 patents related to laser technologies, and the things that have come out of that include laser surgery and barcodes and DVD players and a whole range of things that have come out of that. Everyone is aware of the nuclear components, aware of the internet that came out of DARPA and so on. So obviously there are plenty of examples of where military technology has been extremely important for private sector growth in technology. Now, that being said, you know, economists have tried to identify the channels, and there's some that work in both directions. On the one hand, the spending by the government can create capacity in the economy, you know, create more training for scientists and engineers who can work in both military and non-military areas, can pay the fixed costs of underlying research. And there's a lot of complementarities between the things that happen in the military sector and also happen in the private sector. On the other hand, you can think of ways in which military research is counterproductive. For example, a lot of it is secretive for classified, you know, reasons that it can't be shared easily with the private sector. In some cases, it uses up scarce resources, specific scientific resources, and obviously if they're used up by the military, they're not available for the private sector. So it goes in both ways, but the studies, I think a fair summary would be that the studies that have looked at the empirical relationship between R&D spending at the military, on the military, and R&D spending outside show a positive relationship. The complements are probably somewhat stronger than the substitute effects. So every dollar of extra military R&D not only does not displace a dollar of private sector R&D, it probably adds 20 or 30 cents of extra private sector R&D because of the things that are learned in the military application. So I think that if you want to make a case that U.S. military preparedness and spending have made a positive impact on U.S. growth, it would probably be through the R&D linkages and spillovers, which seem to be positive and seem to have been beneficial. So I think that's an important finding and one that probably argues, in a sense, particularly for more basic research, which, again, the economic case is very strong. But finally, just to wrap up on this, I think, though, that whenever you talk about the effect of some government spending program, you always have to ask yourself, what's the counterfactual? So instead of spending money on specifically on military purposes, if the same money were spent on basic science, that would probably be a better strategy. But all else equal, you know, the evidence does seem to be that military R&D spending has had positive spillovers on private sector spending.
So a related subject, manufacturing, and obviously closely linked in with research and development, but I wanted to ask your thoughts on the defense sector's role in national manufacturing. As we all know, and please correct me if I'm, you know, summarizing incorrectly, but U.S. manufacturing output has been on a small upswing lately, partly due to the shale energy revolution and improved competitiveness. But over time, certainly the number of manufacturing jobs has gone way down, largely because of robotics and automation. But we've been concerned, you know, throughout our adult lives about declining American competitiveness in some industries, and Mark writes on that too. So to what extent does defense play into this? Does it help counter that trend? Is it only going to be helpful in certain specific areas like aerospace? How do you think about defense's role in shoring up the American manufacturing base?
Well, it's important to understand you know, why manufacturing jobs are going down, and you touched on it with the robotics comment that you made. The share of U.S. output that is manufacturing is actually not changed all that much over time. We remain a very big manufacturing economy and exporter, but the number of manufacturing jobs has gone down a lot because manufacturing productivity has grown so quickly that essentially it takes far fewer workers to build an automobile today than it did 20 years ago or 40 years ago, and as a result, with a lot of implications, the number of particularly lower skilled manufacturing jobs has been greatly reduced. If you think about the relationship of that to defense, other than, of course, the fact that defense is indeed a major industry and one that in some sense has to be on shore, or at least most of it has to be on shore, I think that it's important to understand, again, that what's happening to U.S. manufacturing is not in some sense that it's being gutted out. What's happening instead is that we are increasing productivity, which lowers the number of jobs that are created, and also moving up the value-added chain. So we don't make a lot of, simple manufactured goods anymore. We make more sophisticated machine tools and specialized equipment and so on. That has a couple of consequences. One is that we're not heading back towards a manufacturing sector which is going to provide jobs for low-skilled people. It's much more so than in the past, an industry that is going to provide jobs for higher-skilled workers and higher-paid workers. What that means is that the relationship between defense and U.S. manufacturing is probably mostly a complementary one, but for the same reasons I was talking about in terms of R&D, that to the extent that defense manufacturing leads to more sophisticated products and technological advance, it's going to probably support U.S. manufacturing more broadly to some extent, but not. It's not going to take us back to the world of the 1950s when you had, assembly lines with hundreds of workers, building a car. So it is probably a mild positive. Again, it's always a question of what the counterfactual is, where is the money going else otherwise, but it's not taking us back to the pre-technological revolution days of much more labor-intensive manufacturing.
And that leads naturally into the broader question about defense's role in the labor market, and we were talking about that earlier as well. You just touched on the half concerning manufacturing and production of equipment. There's obviously also the direct employees of the Department of Defense, and as, again, most people in this room will know, but a quick reminder, they're in three broad categories. They're about 1.4 million active-duty full-time uniformed personnel, a little bit less than that right now, about 1.4 million. There are almost 800,000 full-time civilians employed by the Department of Defense, full-time government workers, but not in uniform. And then there's about 900 and some thousand in the broader reserve component of the U.S. military, part-time soldiers, sailors, airmen, airwomen, and Marines. So those three categories together represent a couple percent of the U.S. workforce. And then, of course, there's the manufacturing side of things. How do you think about defense's role in the labor market?
Well, we're used to thinking of job creation as a good thing, which of course it is, but you want to avoid sort of the mindset of your congressman who wants to have a base in his district, right? Because the creation of jobs through expenditure by the government, it's creating jobs, yes, but the output of those workers is in some sense is not contributing to the standards of living, it's contributing to a different set of outcomes. So clearly the fact that we have whatever 1.4 million active duty soldiers is in some sense a cost to our economy. I mean, their services are being, obviously they're important. I'm not in any way saying there's too many or too few, but their services are being used for defense purposes and are not obviously contributing to the private economy. And so we shouldn't be confused into saying, oh, the more people we employ in the military, the better. Obviously, on the one hand, you're creating jobs, but on the other hand, the output of those jobs are not contributing to private sector standards of living. So it is a real cost that we have to bear the fiscal and economic burden of a large military, maybe good reasons for it, but it's a cost, not a benefit. A related question, though, I think it's really important, it goes back to this issue about the linkages between defense spending and R&D, is you know, the when you see the Army ads on television, it's kind of like, you know, come in the Army, we'll train you to be a computer scientist or something, and you go out and, you know, and so there's an important question, one that economists have looked at in great detail, is to what extent does Army or military experience add to the training and skills of those workers so that when they go back to the private sector, do they bring with them, you know, skills and earning potential that they otherwise would not have had, and if to the case, to the extent that that's the case for individuals, that's a bit of an offset for the fact that they, you know, their services were not available to the private sector while they were in the military. Now, there have been a lot of really interesting studies of this, and of course, as in economics, nothing is ever finally settled, but the evidence appears to be, though, that there really is not an advantage. I mean, if you go into the military at age 18 versus an identical person who stays in the private sector and, you know, takes a private sector job, 10 years later, if you leave the military, your skills and wages are probably not going to be quite as high on average as the private sector person. One of the great studies of this, one of our colleagues at Princeton, Josh Angris, who I taught in graduate macro, he didn't do this paper in that course, but he did a great paper where he looked at people based on their draft lottery number. Mine was 335, by the way, thank God. So if you had a very low draft number, you had a high chance of being drafted. If you had a very high number, you were not going to be drafted. And so by using that as kind of an instrument, he was able to figure out, you know, how otherwise similar people fared in terms of their long-term labor market experience. And what he found was, again, as I said before, is that people who, you know, went into the Army and then came back out, that they were a little bit, that their skills and pay were actually a little bit below their counterparts for a while. But over time, there was some tendency to move back towards average. But there was not really a benefit. Now, people have broken this down. I mean, it could very well be that the Vietnam era, you know, was a different thing from the all-civilian or the all-volunteer military. And there probably is some difference between having, you know, being trained in combat versus being trained in electronics. There is some difference there. But unfortunately, there doesn't seem to be much evidence that the training implications are all that positive from the military. So, you know, overall, the labor market, the people who go in the military have similar or maybe slightly worse outcomes. For example, if you are a veteran who left after 2001, your current unemployment rate is about 7.2%, as opposed to a national 5.3%. If you are a veteran of any age, though, your unemployment rate is a little bit lower than that. But I think the best way to think about it is that the military takes, you know, our young people and uses them for good purposes, but it's not really adding much to the private sector, you know, through training or other experience. Last comment is there's a whole interesting area which has not seen as much research, which I think is worth looking at, which is the relative experience of reservists versus, you know, longer-term, you know, permanent stationed people. Reservists, on the one hand, they don't leave the private sector, so they're able to continue to accumulate work experience. On the other hand, you know, their work experience is disrupted, you know, by being called to duty. So I think it's a really important question that probably hasn't gotten enough attention is, you know, what's the right combination from an economic point of view? What's the right combination of active duty versus reservist you know, military, and I think that's a question we don't really know the answer to yet.
One last question for you, Ben, in this round. I may ask you later, or let others in the crowd get at the issue of comparing the role of the Fed Reserve Chairman to military Joint Chiefs Chairman or SecDef for some of the political sensitivities and delicacy. We'll save that for later, but before going to Mark, I do want to ask you one more question to wrap the economics discussion together, which is when you think about the nation's deficit, which, of course, has come down, but perhaps only temporarily, and obviously our debt's fairly big compared to GDP, and defense's role within that. What are your broad observations? First on the size of the deficit and trajectory of the deficit, but then also defense's contribution to the deficit.
So it's important to start with a couple of just general observations. One is that the deficit obviously soared, you know, during during the recession, of course, because tax revenues went down by so much. So the ratio of national debt held by the public to our GDP went from about 35% before the crisis and the recession to about 75% today. So there's been a big increase in the amount of debt outstanding. And that has long-run implications for our ability to service any kind of government-provided expenditures, including, of course, military. Now, but the other thing to understand, a couple other facts to understand. One is that while there's a lot of talk about the long-run problems of the deficit, they're really long-run. They're not that short run. So like I said, the debt to GDP ratio in the U.S. today is about 75%. The Congressional Budget Office projects that in 10 years it'll be about 77%. So it's going to be pretty flat. Next few years, deficits are down now to about 2.5% of GDP, which is pretty low. So we're not looking at a big increase in the deficit over the next 10 years or so. Beyond that time, then the Congressional Budget Office has deficits and debt increasing more significantly. And the answer to that question, why that's the case, I think one of the great aphorisms about the federal government is the federal government is basically an insurance company with an army. And it's the insurance part that is the costly part for us, because the projections of big increases in deficits 10, 20 years down the road are mostly tied to the healthcare costs, Medicare, Medicaid, and are based on the projection that healthcare costs will continue to rise at the rapid rate we've seen over the last 20, 30 years. That turns out to be the key issue in terms of long-run deficit planning. If healthcare costs do not grow so quickly, and recently it's been a little bit of good news on that front, then deficits will not be a problem within our lifetime anyway, Mike. So, if that healthcare issues continue to be severe, then that's going to be a constraint on long-term ability of the government to provide various services. But I think the bottom line to draw from this is that it was a mistake that with the sequestration, those things, that there were these inefficiencies, there were these steps taken to correct the deficit in the very short run that probably had long-run costs in terms of preparedness, in terms of canceling systems that were midway and that sort of thing. So I would just conclude by saying that there's nothing in our deficit prospect that should make us distort our defense planning in the near term. And we should be making our decisions based on medium-term considerations, based on what makes the most sense in terms of efficiency for achieving our objectives. There's no reason to be taking draconian steps right now to that will have long-run costly implications for our defense posture just for deficit reasons. The deficit is a longer-run issue, and we should be thinking about it in a longer-run context.
Very helpful. Mark, I want to now ask you a couple of questions. You've listened to Ben, and so there's a lot on the table. And I just wanted to ask you to reflect and react, but also specifically to, again, bring back your interest and focus on advanced industry and on some key geographic sectors in the United States where some of the kind of partnerships you've written about may involve defense as a player. Just how would you interpret some of these same questions, especially on the issues of research and development, advanced industry, and manufacturing?
Absolutely. And thanks, Mike, for having me. Great to be here with you, Ben, and the whole foreign policy and economic studies teams. So right off, I'll just really appreciate the focus on what defense actually is here rather than some of the bumper stickers. And I'll just add to begin with, no doubt it's an important component everywhere for the most part, but I do want to make the point that though there are 4,000 bases out there in hundreds and hundreds of communities across the country, defense itself varies widely from place to place. We're the metropolitan. I'm with the Metropolitan Policy Program. We're very interested in subnational variation, and you touched on it. But if you look at the projected defense purchases detail by industry and state DoD publication, you do get to quite wide variation of the local importance of this economy. I think you touched on this a little bit. We don't think where defense doesn't matter very much too often. But in fact, New York, Oregon, Minnesota, Michigan, West Virginia, it's less than 1% of state GDP. So, and then, as you alluded to, Virginia, Hawaii, Maine, Mississippi, D.C., Alabama, Kentucky, Alaska, 6 to 6.5%. So a significant local importance. So we're having a conversation, we need to have multiple conversations when we talk about economic impact. And it's not a uniform, you know, it's not flat across space. It's spiky. It's hugely important in a short list of places, massively crucial anchor in certain places like, you know, Virginia, for instance, or Kentucky, Colorado. So many places absolutely right to be thinking about, you know, very concerned about the local economic impacts, but many places not so much. But I'm less worried about these aspects of the economy, the defense economy, than the extent to which U.S. military expenditures, in the absence of systematic thinking about our economic base, remain the nation's main driver, or a significant driver has been suggested, of high-value industrial activity, especially technology innovation. I think while these effects may be declining over time, we're talking about, you know, a 70, 80, 90-year history of investment and experimentation that has left us with a critical sense, a set of industries, so that we need to think about. And what I'm going to argue here is that we need, as we think about the size of the military posture, consider the rest of our economic strategy to ensure that we protect and build these industries. So, you know, my group here at Brookings has identified what we call the nation's advanced industries, 50 high R&D, high STEM, in STEM intensive industries that inordinately anchor the economy. That's not just a claim. You know, these inordinately drive patenting, inordinately drive innovation, productivity, growth, exports, and so on. So they really are, you know, about only about 10% of the economy in terms of employment, but a significant driver of our global prosperity. You know, so ranging from aerospace, semiconductors, medical device manufacturer, but also, so those manufacturing side, but a number of energy initiatives, renewables, fracking is critical here, and then high-tech services like computer services design, computer systems design. So the point here, though, is, you know, these reflect decades of productive interaction between the military and the private sector, including those secret pieces, including inadvertent spillovers of knowledge. They reflect decades of strategic capacity building, maybe inefficient, maybe not. And then decades of directed DoD procurement. So I'm looking at a different channel of reaction. So, and I'll go further. In the absence of, you know, a consistent, urgent, non-military industry strategy, such as many of our competitors, whether it's Germany, South Korea, or China, have had, defense expenditures have functioned as something of a stealth industrial policy. For better or worse, I'm arguing on balance, they have been helpful. The defense budget has turned out to be the only place that one could argue for and deliver certain kinds of useful economic industry innovation, because somewhat beyond criticism for a long time. So in that sense, since World War II, this has arguably been the nation's steadiest and most creative supporter of technology progress. You know, I won't bore you with a lot of the anecdotes that I think Ben alluded to, but, you know, World War II, key source of funding for foundational scientific research. Manhattan Project created the National Lab System, arguably one of our most important distributed networks of in a core piece of the innovation system. DARPA, with its experiments in new formats of blue sky inventive thinking, establishing in many respects the startup as an idea, promoting decentralized network in innovation, sophisticated kind of initiative that is, I think, not just in its spending or its science led to structural approaches, structural innovations, and clearly recent just heavy investments in emerging fields, whether it's computer science, material science, solid state, atomic movements, data analytics, robotics. The list goes on. So, and then it's deployed huge procurement budgets. So this is a different, in this sense, not just early stage R&D, but creating markets for new technologies. In this regard, my friend Dan Sarowitz, Arizona State University, stresses the special attributes of military innovation. This is a focused mission. Enduring ties to the private sector have been a distinctive feature of the military enterprise, and then this role as an early customer for advanced technologies. Whether it be nanophotonic microprocessors or artificial intelligence software, data analytics, to some extent, the military continues to not just make the early investments, but to be a discerning, strategic, early customer. So that's what I worry about. And the question isn't simply to maintain the military effort at its size for perhaps inefficient, to maintain perhaps inefficient innovation and industry benefits, but it's about making sure that we look at the overall economy and consider other maybe civilian interventions that would parallel that.
You make a really good point, which is, in an ideal world, we would have government-sponsored basic research, and many of these things you talk about would be coming out of long-run considerations for technical change and need to maintain technological leadership. Our political system is not good at investing in long-run, making long-run investments with uncertain payoffs. And the political impact of military R&D is that people can concretely see, the effects that military spending has a privileged place in the political system. It's unfortunate in a way. That's the main reason that we're getting this. That, again, ideally we would have a much broader based program that would look at both non-military and military uses, but this appears to be one of the main functions of military spending, is to create a political basis and support for.
I think to date, necessary interventions have migrated to the defense budget for delivery. I think the request here, or the call here, I think very much in your spirit, is to have a broader discussion in which the defense budget is simply a component of a coherent national stance, which may be laissez-faire in the end, but I don't think it would be.
So one more question for me, too, and then we can involve all of you in the discussion as well. As I hear you, Mark, and building on what Ben just asked, it sounds like you're impressed by the ways in which the defense sector has contributed to national economic growth, but also aware of at least two limitations. One, defense is coming down as a percent of national resources, and therefore it's not going to be as adequate as it might have been. And secondly, we just need a better civilian strategy to complement, as Ben was saying, because I've read your reports on advanced industry, and you're not that happy about where we stand internationally and competitively right now. So am I correct in hearing that what you'd like to see is sustained solid support in some sense for defense, not throw away the baby with the bathwater, keep that part, but complement it with a stronger civilian strategy?
I think from a defense economy point of view, I'm somewhat agnostic. The question is, are we going to maintain an economic posture or an economic stance that clearly centrally will have a public-private collaborative element. And this is not an argument for heavy-handed industrial policy, but it is about a degree of public investment, public creativity, and experimentation in partnership with the private sector.
Let me ask one follow-up to maybe give a couple of the highlights of what you wrote about in regard to Colorado as a case study, and then maybe Ben has a follow-up, and if not, we'll go to all of you. But I would just think that to make this concrete, you could maybe tell a little bit about what's in that excellent report from, I guess, now 2 years ago?
Yeah.
Please.
We came on the scene there at a time of consternation, late 2011, concern about looming discussion of sequestration, and found regional economic development officials, various military leaders, and progressive Democratic governor, John Hickenlooper, very concerned about threats to a Front Range complex of bases that harbored significant high-end data, missile preparedness, communications capabilities that had yielded or created along the Front Range, a extremely, real exemplar of the kind of side effect economies that can grow up in regional ecosystems around these kinds of complexes that in this case, were built up not for economic reasons, but had yielded, a major aerospace, space defense complex that had begun to move towards new commercial applications and in some cases had begun to evolve away from government contracting already. So we arrived, looked at this, surveyed especially the space aerospace piece, recommended, acceleration wherever possible of the move off the dole and into the commercial space location where they have, companies that are delivering Earth observation technologies that you all have are using on your cell phones when you use Google Maps, for instance, major companies, where services being hung off of technology and launch capability were allowing significant commercial growth. So a strategy emerged there. This is a state that, it wants to make sure that it continues that evolution, wants to protect the base, but also move into commercial applications, a kind of diversification strategy. And I would just hold this up as an example, I think, of another factor, which is going to be the kind of responses of subnational actors around this huge federal activity. This is a state that created an industry champion to both watch the military budget, but also work to build networking among various space-related industries, wound up creating a $200 million accelerator program for supporting small startups in the space. So I think this is another factor that we're going to see is subnational response to changing divisions of labor. And in this sense, quite productive, I think, and may represent the first glimpse of a kind of new division of labor as the defense budget shrinks.
When you look at regional development, though, there's always the question of how much of the motivation is basically, zero-sum game type, where parts of the country are looking for additional federal funding, ultimately at the expense of all the taxpayers. So certainly, given the interest of local politicians, it's got to be part of what's going on. At the same time, I'm not really trying to disagree with what you're saying, because technological change and innovation are ultimately local
events involve networking among different groups, private sector, universities, you know, defense, and so on. So it has to happen somewhere. So I think I agree with you that this is just an example of the positive spillovers of defense spending R&D. But again, as we try to evaluate these types of projects, we have to take into account sort of the regional benefits vis-a-vis the national benefits, not always the same.
I find healthiest there, in fact, the desire to diversify in the movement to identify commercial adjacent opportunities. Clearly there's a dimension of defending the base that is legitimate, I think, or expectable, but I think the accent in Colorado seems to be on diversification. And we see this all across the country, in many of these places with, 6% plus shares of the economy in defense are looking at it that way, I think.
Excellent. Well, let's go to you. Please wait for a microphone. We'll go up here, a woman in the green shirt first, and maybe we'll do a little bit of this third row just for a second. And please identify yourself, and please just ask one question if you could so we make sure we have enough time.
Thank you so much. Jennifer Chen, reporter with Shenzhen Media Group, one of TV network in China. I have questions to Mr. Bernanke. So do you think it's about renminbi's devaluation. So do you think the China's move to devalue its currency is going to exacerbate the U.S. trade deficit? And is there any negative impact to U.S. economy? And will it lead to the Fed to raise the interest rates? Also, do you think the floating of the exchange rate of renminbi will do any help for it to join the SDR? Thank you so much.
Before I give the floor to Ben, I'm going to say one thing I should have said sooner about ground rules, which is that I'm going to try to protect my colleague in any question he doesn't want to answer because it's not directly pertinent to today's topic and or it might be relevant to his book launch. We're going to give him the right to defer. But having said that,
you're confusing me with the chairman of the Fed. I would just say that in some sense what China is doing is what we've asked them to do, which is to let more market forces play a role in determining the value of the currency. And that's, we're seeing the Chinese currency appreciated very considerably because of its being tied to the dollar, and that put pressure on Chinese economy. So this is a liberalization that is actually moving in the direction of more market determination of the exchange rate, which is something that the U.S. has actually asked for a long time.
Next question here. Same row, please.
Liam Nye, Penn State University. Mark, in your findings, what impact have universities had on the overall growth of the economies in these high-tech industries such as aerospace? And what have you found is the best way to leverage the skills and talent at universities to contribute to the national defense and overall economic growth?
Yeah, great question. Let me provide one note of prehistory, which is that to an extent, in a number of circumstances, the military's actually created university departments, for instance, in computer science, for instance, or invested in building the high-level academic knowledge. So that has been another beneficial set of activities in this ongoing interaction between, I think, big government in the form of the military and private universities, public universities. So absolutely crucial, clearly, in building the skill sets and creating much of the IP that has fueled this system. I think it's absolutely crucial. I think that has been a continued dynamic, and we see the interaction also between defense early purchasing and early program development has been also a way of employing people coming out of the universities. So I think you get these dynamic local ecosystems that, almost as a side product, create these advanced industry ecosystems as well.
We routinely, when they rate
the top universities in the world, the U.S. routinely gets like three quarters of the top 25 or so. It's a huge national asset that we need to make sure we're making best use of. And we've become, by the way, we've become much better at interacting between universities and the private sector and government. That's become a much more efficient process in the United States, and that's something we should take advantage of.
I think the military history has been important in working out those patterns, and I think that's now becoming a standard way of operating.
Stay in the third row, one more note.
Thank you so much. I'm Yasser Al-Fakharani, ICMJ Fellow. My question to Mr. Ben, to what extent do you think the Middle East situation in the Middle East and also Africa, ISIL and Boko Haram and these groups, to what extent do you think they have affected already the defense spending and military budget of the United States? Thank you.
Well, I'm going to ask you to jump in on this, Mike, because Mike's done great work on trying to evaluate specific threats and specific objectives of the military and pointing out that you need different types of capacities for different situations. Yeah. I mean, one of the things, and I'm speaking totally as an amateur here, but one of the obvious things about warfare in the last few decades is how little of it is sort of between large national armies and how much of it is sort of symmetric warfare of various kinds, dealing with lack of information and embedded guerrillas and all those sorts of things. And obviously, there was a story this morning about how the U.S. is beginning to use much more drone monitoring, for example. So the set of technologies that you're using and the set of military strategies obviously has to adapt to the nature of the challenge, and we're seeing a lot of change there. Mike?
I'll add 2 points. One of them on economics, so I may need to be corrected here in a moment, but the economics observation is, if you had told me 20 years ago, 30 years ago, you could have this much turmoil in the Middle East and oil prices would have taken a dive and sustained that, I would have been flummoxed. And I would have said, well, Professor Bernanke, what is it about your course that I didn't study? There's something going on here that I did not know how to predict. So that's one observation, which obviously we know some of the answers, but I'm still stunned that this could be true. But secondly, I'm also somewhat surprised that so far we really haven't changed our defense posture very much. So the defense budget cuts have continued. The drawdown in the force has continued, very modestly in the size of the force, but it's still been in the downward direction. And certainly General Odierno, who retired last week as Army Chief of Staff, lamented to some extent the degree to which the Army is suffering the brunt of these reductions, and that hasn't changed in official planning since the rise of ISIL. I think your question was primarily about the last year to 2 years and the dynamics we've seen. So that would be a second point. My third and final point is, however, pushing somewhat in the other direction, is that I would expect, Rand Paul and Bernie Sanders notwithstanding, that most of the political energy in the next year and a quarter in the presidential election is going to be to push to the right in defense terms, and that we will see major candidates of both parties advocating at least modest increases in defense spending, recognizing that threats have gone up a bit, and we haven't even talked about Russia and Ukraine. And that, as Chairman Bernanke just said, we don't have to be so rushed in our concern about bringing down the deficit as to ignore what might be needed for broader national security purposes. Now, I'm not suggesting we're going to have a 2015 or 2017 equivalent of the Reagan buildup, but I think we will see modest real growth proposed by either party's presidential candidate once we get through it. The next 6 weeks are interesting in Washington because of the looming sequester, and frankly, I'm a little surprised that that there hasn't been a better effort by the two branches of government responsible for this to make sure we don't sequester defense at this juncture. I think it would be a big, big mistake, and so here's a plea from a think tank guy to please find a way to avoid sequester, because we don't need it, and it would be counterproductive for the kind of issues you're raising. Over here in the third row.
Yes, thank you, Michael, Mark, Chairman Bernanke, thank you for your time. I'm Tom Risen with U.S. News and World Report. I like what you said about how the government is not too good at uncertain investments over time. I've spoken to some people who are in the startup community who are unhappy with the federal procurement process. How do you think that we could make the defense spending better for to fund promising projects quicker and make sure that projects don't continue longer than they need to? Because startups have a very short lifetime. They need money really fast. The federal procurement process can take too long for them. How do you think we can improve the federal procurement process to be more like a startup model?
I think I don't really know the answer to the question, but I will try to answer the following. You were asking me before about the linkage, the parallels between the Defense Department and the Federal Reserve, and one of them, if I may, is one of them is that you know the Fed is also engaged in a technically complex activity with long run implications, the same as the Pentagon in that respect. And the way the Fed has managed its relationship with Congress is that at least ideally the Fed is what's called instrument independent, which means that it gets to make the decisions about how its objectives are met. However, the Congress sets the objectives. Congress ideally does not interfere, for example, in interest rate policy directly, but it says, well, we're charging you, the Fed, with achieving maximum employment price stability. And so the Fed has to explain how it's going to achieve those objectives, but it uses its technical knowledge and its long-term perspective to achieve that. Now, we can't use the same model for, I don't want to pretend that you can use the same model for defense. The objectives are much more complicated, they're much more harder to evaluate, there's much less short-run feedback from defense. So you can't really say to the Pentagon, here, we want you to defend America, and you decide how to do it. We can't do that, obviously. But I think you could move in the direction of Congress and its oversight bodies specifying the particular objectives and goals and capacities that it wants the military to have, and giving more scope to either the military itself or impartial commissions or other groups to sort of make some of those decisions so that you're not having politically determined base locations and politically determined procurement decisions and those things. I'm not naive enough to think we're going to get all the way there, but we could move in the direction, like the Base Closing Commission is a good example of having more independent objective analysis that is then subject to sort of an up or down vote or a single decision by the Congress. And so in what you're describing, again, if there was more flexibility to the military planners to meet their objectives, you know, subject to fiscal constraints and so on, that there would be more opportunity for them to have that flexibility, that otherwise too much intervention in those decisions is blocking.
I'd just jump in. First there are hints in the fact that these are mission-oriented agencies that may provide a hint towards where this could go, with much more focus on actual delivered capabilities, I think, such as Ben is talking about. I would also note that within the defense corpus, there have been successful experiments, sometimes famous ones, for instance, DARPA, more recently InQtel, that you know the CIA's kind of venture effort that actually do this, that have short applications, quick grant cycles, and are built on speed, and in fact have wound up influencing other agencies and the private sector even. So I think so much has been spent, so much has been attempted in the military history, then that's to some extent the answers are within the military system as well,
And as I'll add a word here as well, it's a complex subject, and the answer is going to vary in a way from what type of technology you're talking about, one to another. We had an event on acquisition reform for the Department of Defense at Brookings in April, and Frank Kendall spoke. He's the Undersecretary of Defense for Acquisition, and I asked him, how well do you think we're doing in acquisition? Now, he's got an incentive to say we're doing okay. On the other hand, he's put out three successive better buying power roadmaps for how we can improve, and he's trying to energize the case for reform. But he basically said, I think we're sort of a B+, because look at it this way, whenever we go to war, we got the best stuff in the world. But then after him, we had Bill Lynn come up on stage, and I asked Bill the same question. Bill had been the Deputy Secretary of Defense, also in the Obama administration. So they're teammates in some broader sense. But Bill now runs a small company, Finmeccanica, the U.S. arm of the Italian aerospace company. And Bill said, I think we're pretty good at the big stuff, like Secretary Kendall said. And the cost overruns and the delays are sometimes, unfortunate, but you produce a great system in the end. But we're bad at anything that's touched by Moore's Law, anything concerning electronics. So the very kinds of things that are on your mind when you're asking that question, those specific technologies is where Bill thinks we need to find better ways. And there already is legal code that allows you to use some commercial
procurement practices, but we don't do it very often. The military services tend to get very conservative in these kind of situations. So anyway, there's a million dimensions to the problem and a million answers, but I would just begin by saying some parts of the problem are more serious than others. The overall system is not fundamentally broken. There are parts of it that are broken, in my judgment. Way over here on the far side, please.
Andrew Bernstein, Sputnik International News, for Dr. Bernanke. It's been said that the U.S. ability to project power is very closely linked to economic power. So in your view, at what point does the debt become such an issue that it actually impacts U.S. ability to project power abroad?
You said the debt? U.S. debt? Yeah, okay. So I said earlier that I didn't think that it was right to distort near-term military planning or defense planning because of the deficit, because the deficit is a longer-term issue, and debt is a longer-term issue. But that being said, in the long run, to a first approximation, whatever additional spending we do, we have to pay for somehow, and essentially with higher taxes in the end. And clearly, with a higher debt-to-GDP ratio, our resources are more constrained than they used to be. So I can't give you a number which says beyond a certain, there's a very sorry history of trying to pick specific numbers where things will go wrong. It doesn't really work. But I certainly didn't mean to imply that we, in the end, we don't have to think about our long-run national capacity and our resources. And again, I don't think we're at that point now. I don't think that we should be distorting near-term decisions. But we do need to think about, over a period of decades, what objectives we have as a country, both foreign policy and military objectives, and understand that those things are constrained by our economic power. It's a very complicated relationship between economic growth and the military. We've been talking about some of the positive relationships, but we also know the work on rise and fall of great powers, which suggests beyond a certain point you can become overextended, and the commitment of resources to military purposes can actually be very negative for your economy and your long-run ability to project power. So what I'm trying to say is, short run, I think we're fine, but over the longer term, we do have to think about the resource constraints on our economy and make sure that we're not undertaking commitments globally, militarily, that our economy can't sustain in the long term.
Could I build on that by asking, Ben, about how you looked at things in the crunch period around, 2008, 9, 10, and to what extent was this question on your mind? I mean, obviously, your main concern, I think, was to prevent the Great Recession from becoming the second Great Depression, and you were a firefighter in some ways, and you were trying to find creative ways to save the economy. I don't know if you were thinking in terms of long-term American national power, but in our political science and foreign policy worlds, a lot of people were, at that moment, writing about how China was perceived to be rising, and the perception was growing even faster, perhaps, than the reality, partly because of the Great Recession. To what extent did any of those thoughts enter into your calculus back then?
Well, I was certainly thinking about both the short term and the long term. And certainly one of the reasons that we had so much doubt, and I think there still is in the political arena a lot of doubt and angst, was because we didn't really know in 2008, 2009, we didn't know exactly how things were going to come out. We didn't know whether this was just a bad recession or something much deeper and longer. So obviously there was a lot of questioning about what our long-run capacity was going to be. What we've seen is that a lot, not all, but a lot of the decline in output we saw after the financial crisis was cyclical. That is, there's been significant recovery, not complete, but significant recovery in output and employment. And so the longer run implications are, I think, less than we were worried about in 2008. In particular, one point I did make very consistently in actual real time was that, notwithstanding the scary deficit numbers that we were seeing, and there were 10% of GDP is a very big deficit, which we were close to that early on. Notwithstanding those scary numbers, I didn't think, I said at the time, I didn't think that
2008, 2009, 2010 was the right time to be going into fiscal austerity, that we needed to be thinking about long-run fiscal constraints, but in the short run, we needed to give the economy a chance to recover before we started cutting. And so in the short run, my advice to Congress at the time was, you know, let's let the economy recover, let's not go into austerity mode yet, but obviously we need, at the same time that we're thinking about recovery and the contribution of fiscal policy to recovery, we also need to be thinking about the long-run constraints that we're facing, and that's the right trade-off, I thought, at the time.
Right. Well, we've got a couple more rounds here. I think I'm going to take two at a time now, so we can make sure we get a few more questions in before we run out of time. So why don't we do this gentleman here, and then in the black shirt in the fourth row, and then we'll respond to those together.
There's been a recent push.
Name, please.
Brian Dulk. There's been a recent push in the fast food industry to raise the minimum wage to $15. It would give a full-time employee a gross pay of about $30,000 a year. In contrast, in the military, a newly minted officer with a college education earns in the low 30,000s, and a new enlisted military personnel is about 18,000. Would you discuss how that raise in minimum wage would impact the military costs, especially with 1.4 million active duty personnel?
And then take this question here as well, please.
Yeah, name's John Tominski. Can you talk about the consolidation in the defense industries and whether you think that's on balance good, or does that consolidation lead to mega projects that have a life of their own, and just the economies of scale that would bring, and how do you actually politically address those?
I'm going to take whichever fraction, and I'll try to.
Well, on the minimum wage, how much that minimum wage constrains demand for labor depends a lot on the local conditions. I mean, wages are different in different parts of the country. In some parts of the country, that wouldn't be very far from what low-paid workers do get. Other parts of the country, that would be very high and would be probably would squeeze some workers out of employment. So obviously, the military has to maintain competitive wages. I haven't done the study; I can't give you the exact numbers. But my impression is that military pay is pretty competitive. That that the military is able to attract, on average, pretty good quality recruits and relatively skilled workers. So I would turn to my colleagues on this one, but it's not my impression at this point that labor market constraints are preventing the military from meeting its needs. And I don't think that some increase in minimum wage, whatever the benefits or costs of that, and I'm not going to address that broader question, I don't think that would be a major concern. And of course, if necessary, the military can make adjustments.
Right. That's right. There's a quadrennial review of military compensation you're probably familiar with that comes out every 4 years, and the last one looked across various strata of the defense demographic, and what it basically found is if you compare the typical person in uniform to a person of the same age and experience, educational level, test proficiency in the private sector, military pay for enlisted personnel is at about the 85th percentile. In other words, they make 85% more than, or more than 85% of all people of similar cohort. That includes their allowance for housing and their health care benefits. Does not include military pension into the calculation. It's not to say they make enough. That's a separate ethical and moral question as to whether we're doing enough for them when we send them off to war. But in terms of how we're handling the labor market, so far it's been okay. But you raise a good point. Hypothetically, if we go to a higher minimum wage and the economic recovery that Chairman Bernanke and others have engendered continues, you may have some recruiting issues that in recent years we really haven't. So we have to keep our eye on that very carefully. Do you want to try the defense industry consolidation question, or Mark?
Mark, that's Mark's question.
I can say that we've certainly seen that, again, there will be a calculus between places, and you'll see consolidation into certain places that'll, at a geographical level, that will profit from this, and others not. But I think the larger question is the structure of the economies and industry that exists to deliver, you know, mission critical
products. And I think, you know, the question is about maintaining sufficient competitiveness, I think. And there has been a lot of consolidation already, I think Mike can talk about. But, you know, the question is, what is the right spot?
Yeah, I think it's sector by sector. You know, we're down to five or six major shipyards. That's probably okay, but it's not five or six separate independent companies. We've got basically two companies making fighter jets, two companies making fighter jet engines. There's a single consolidated production line now, or a single effort associated with nuclear-propelled submarines and aircraft carriers. Some of the work is shared across two different shipyards in two different states. So sector by sector, we usually have a couple, but that's not true in every domain. And we've got a big decision looming in coming weeks or months, which is about the long-range bomber. And as you probably know, there are two main competitors, and Boeing and Lockheed are involved in one, and Northrop in the other. Boeing and Lockheed are the two companies making a lot of fighter jets still today, and making other kinds of aircraft as well. Northrop Grumman makes a lot of drones, but their fate as a future manned aerospace company probably hinges to a large extent in the balance of who wins this competition. How would we feel if we lost Northrop, hypothetically, in that space? I would be somewhat concerned. So I think that's the kind of place where you go from 2-1 or even 3-2, where you've got to ask yourself hard questions, and maybe you are willing to pay a little bit of a premium in terms of having two separate production lines to retain the independent design and production capabilities if you can find a reasonably economical way to do it. Now, with aircraft carriers, we don't do that because it's just too much. So there's only one place we build them, in Virginia, and that's it for the country. And we just have to hope that Newport News Shipbuilding continues to deliver well. But you know, I have to say, they do deliver well, but the new carrier costs two and a half times what the old carrier does, and I'm a little troubled by that trend. So this is where you do worry about losing some competition, and I think your question's right on the money. The problem is there's no perfect answer, and as we continue to have defense budgets stay about the same or shrink a little, and the average cost per weapon keeps going up because of high technology, you're going to have more and more of these decisions to make. So the next one is the long-range strike bomber, and again, I'm still sorting through the economics and the national security dimensions of that. Let's go in the back here next to the camera, please.
Yes, hi. Creighton Jones, Future Science Foundation. So my question is, getting back to this topic of bridging the relationship between the defense and the civilian economy, what do you think of the prospects of, while maintaining the inputs that we get from defense and R&D and manufacturing, bringing more of that, the final expenditure of that activity domestically, such as through expanding the role of the Army Corps of Engineers in terms of size and scope, or creating programs for returning soldiers to engage in actual nation-building types of activity, such that you sort of start to close that cycle of import, of, you know, input and output, but it actually the final product is expended here in the United States itself. You know, close in particular the multi-trillion-dollar infrastructure gap that we currently have.
Now let's take one more question before we go to responses here. So, we'll go in the back, gentleman in the tie with his hand up. Here comes the microphone.
I appreciate all your comments so far. I noticed the principle of draconian measures in case the budget balance gets to be a very serious issue with the GDP, which may occur. I wonder, there's a problem with the sequester, as we heard following that's a problem. Now, what to do? In 1939, FDR was faced with a problem with Britain and the situation in Europe, and they told Britain, we'll give you what you want, but this principle is cash and carry. By January 41, they were out of money, and we moved into lend-lease. Currently, we just merely provide a great deal of weapons to countries and don't charge them a thing. I wonder, how long can this keep up? Is this the right way to proceed?
Why don't we take one last question and make it the final round, and then we'll maybe divvy things up one by one. Sir, here in the white shirt.
Yes, hi, Graham Vise with Inside Sources. You had spoke earlier about the sort of implications of all of this for labor and for workers. You talked about the debates over how much the training actually benefits workers, and I'm just curious, as you look sort of long term and you consider the maybe cutbacks or maybe future increases in the defense budget and defense spending, what other sort of implications does that have for workers, for the sort of quality of jobs for low-skilled folks, for the higher-skilled folks, and then maybe, talking about different metro areas, what are the sort of differences in different parts of the country in terms of that issue?
If you like, I can try to begin with the first two questions and then pass you guys to conclude with whatever the comments.
Go for it.
So on the first two questions, very fair points, but I would point out that in broad terms, we're already doing pretty well by the standards that you identified. In other words, American defense manufacturing is largely an export-oriented sector. They do export a fair number of weapons abroad. Most of the money in the defense budget is spent by and for American firms. Most of it is spent in the United States. We've downsized overseas bases just as dramatically, actually more so than we have domestic bases. So there's always room to look at another example and say we could do better here. But we also have to maintain a sense of fair trade, because we are trying to continue to persuade overseas customers to buy our stuff, and if we never think about buying theirs, it's hard to maintain the culture that says we should be open and fair. So overall, I'm less concerned perhaps about the broad picture than you might be, and I do think defense trade is an advantage for the American economy right now. We do more exporting than we do importing. And on this issue, sir, related question of where we're giving away weapons, there are some good debates to be had, but they only concern three or four important countries, three or four big chunks of money. So we're giving a lot of security assistance to Egypt. Myself, I think it's too much because I don't want to support President Sisi quite as categorically as we are, but it's not so much for the reason you mentioned. That's a fair debate. And then we have, of course, Afghanistan, where we essentially fund their army and police, and we're going to have to keep doing that for a number of years. Not so much high technology weaponry, more salaries, although a little bit of both. We give a lot of ongoing help to Israel, but Israel makes its own decisions about where to buy weapons and often makes its own weapons. And the Gulf states in the Middle East, they buy weapons with the money that they earn from the oil economy. Same thing for East Asian partners. Same thing for European allies with other, obviously they all make their own revenues in different ways, but they're all capable of paying and they tend to pay. So you can have good debates about, from a foreign policy point of view, should we be giving as much money to Afghanistan, to Egypt, to Israel, to some extent to Iraq, although we're not giving very much right now. But I don't think it's fundamentally a big problem about most of our defense exports depending on the taxpayer largesse. Defense industry is competitive. American defense industry is competitive, and it's winning a lot of contracts with paying customers, again, largely in the Middle East, East Asia, and Europe already today. I'll leave my answers at that. Ben, over to you.
Well, just in the last one about cutbacks, going back to the question about the debt and so on, I mean, having a large military is an economic burden, ultimately, for the most part. I mean, it uses up resources and tax money that could otherwise be used. But to the extent it has benefits, I mean, one of the ones I think we've identified today is on the technological spillovers and productivity spillovers. And in particular, as Marcus was pointing out, that it seems politically, unfortunately, seems easier to get some of those things funded and supported via, in the context of defense spending, than it would be in a more general, civilian context. So I think that's an important consideration. We want to make sure that we remain technically and technologically competitive, and that does affect. It affects different workers differently, of course, but it does affect the overall prosperity of our economy, and ultimately it affects, I think, most workers, the ability of our country to produce at a high level and with high productivity. So I think that's the main thing that I feel a little bit uncomfortable about, because we are in fact reducing our reliance on federal and defense-oriented R&D, in the sense that that's been coming down as a share of total R&D, but
there is a good economic case for government support for basic research and research with broad-based spillovers, to the extent that cutbacks in military mean cutbacks in that kind of research as well. I think that's something to be concerned about.
And I'll throw in on a parallel basis, the military clearly anchored the creation of the sort of baseline STEM workforce in this country, and we're clearly seeing the shrinkage of that, the aging of that in many of the defense industries and in the services. So I think parallel to what Ben is saying, and I've been saying, there's also a transition in our training posture, both for the military and the rest of the economy. And again, I think we've not been arguing for a certain size of the military, but we have been arguing for a competitiveness of the nation, both on the military side, but also economically. So I think you see that that's a huge question, as you're hearing in the innovation space, but also in skills and in the defense manufacturing base, which I think we're seeing there. The technology side is now, I think, lifted the manufacturing base to an extent where it is now much more competitive than it was, even though it is not hiring to the same extent. So I think there's a real transition here that's about the trend for the defense budget, but then what about the rest of the budget, and or are there other sources for delivering these services that are needed, that we can leverage?
Unless there are any final words, I think we'll recognize there are a lot more topics to explore. Yeah. We haven't come up with an industrial policy for solving the Washington Nationals decline, among other topics. So please stay tuned. We have a full agenda coming up in the fall, including, of course, Ben's book. But thank you all very much for being here.
The Lawfare Podcast is produced in cooperation with the Brookings Institution. Our music is performed by Sophia Yan. And as always, please spread the word and promote the Lawfare Podcast on your social networks, Twitter, Facebook, email, and in any other way you can. Thanks for listening.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house, with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. WarbyParker.com/covered.